With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. I am Jake Cunningham. My doubles partner this week is Sam Howlett. And he will be serving you some ace thoughts on the latest tennis film you can be courting at the cinema.
Very nice. Very nice. That sound was me serving.
Yeah. That was good. It's a good sound effect. Yeah. If anyone needs Foley services, do contact Sam. Yes, it is the Battle of the Sexes, which is out this week.
Yeah, so this is a true-life tennis drama where Bobby Riggs, who was a much older male player who had gone into retirement, he challenged Billie Jean King, who is played by Emma Stone, Bobby Riggs' Steve Carell, to a tennis match, which became known as the Battle of the Sexes, which was a huge sporting event, which was watched by over 90 million people.
Excellent. And yes, so this film has been directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, who people may know as the directors of Little Miss Sunshine and Ruby Sparks. Mm-hmm. And you spoke to them about the film, as well as speaking to Andrea Riseborough, who is also in the film, along with Emma Stone and Steve Carell and Bill Pullman and Sarah Silverman. It's a ensemble cast. And it's kind of begun a award trajectory. It starts, a lot of people were talking about it earlier in the year, and we're kind of reaching the apex of that bell curve discussion.
Yeah, I think that they're going for the acting noms with this film. Emma Stone, hot off the heels of La La Land, so she's still in people's minds in terms of awards and prestige. So I think it's going to go down that route. And I think it has a fair shot of some nominations.
Yeah, definitely. And it's not the only film out this week. Beach Rats is also out this week in cinemas and on Curzon Home Cinema. And we will be talking about that later on as well. But before we get into a deep discussion about the film, it might be best to start by talking to the creators of it, Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris.
Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton, thank you for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
So when I first heard about this film many years ago, I read it as a Danny Boyle film. So could you tell us a bit about how you two came aboard?
Well, Danny began work on this, but then Trainspotting 2 came together, and it was the time to do it. He had to grab the actors when they were all available. So we fortunately were brought in, and
I think it was what we got was sort of a first draft that he and Simon worked on, and so then we spent about a year and a half with Simon and worked it. It made it in, you know, it was very much a Danny Boyle film, and which we love, but we didn't want to try to make.
He does it so much better.
He's much better at doing Danny Boyle films than we are. So we you know, kind of made it our own and changed some things, and it was great working with Simon. Yeah. And then he worked, you know, and Billie Jean was involved at that point.
But it was fun to have Danny sort of peering over our shoulder once in a while. And, you know, we never get to have that interaction with a fellow director. So,
And as a director who, you know, he's very sensitive to not wanting to be a producer.
Right.
You know, just wanting to be a support, and that was incredible.
Yeah, our work, so that was fun.
So what kind of changes did you make to make it your film in the script process?
I think there was a lot more going on. There were even more characters than there are in the current film. So we sort of stripped it back and maybe put a little more focus on the relationship with Marilyn and Billie Jean. Mm-hmm. And that sort of the triangle with Larry. It was all there, but we just maybe brought up that relationship and we made it more of her first real relationship with a woman.
But yeah, I think we got a little further into the personal stories.
Okay. So can you talk a bit then about your prior knowledge to the events of the film and your sort of opinions to it before and after making the film?
Well, we're old enough to remember the event.
Okay.
But and it was a big deal. But I think we didn't know, and I think the public didn't know, that there were all these things happening behind the scenes.
Right.
In the personal lives of the two characters. So that was an important thing for us to tell. And, you know, I think a lot of people know Billie Jean as a gay person, but, you know, at the time of the match, she was married to a man and having her first relationship with a woman secretly, and that was a story we thought was worth telling.
While she was, you know, fighting for women's equal pay in tennis, I mean, she had so much at stake. And so we were really interested in the fact that she could sort of, you know, with all of that on the line, still, you know, follow her desires and give herself permission to do that.
And you mentioned there about kind of, you know, telling the story about behind the tennis. But in you do have to film tennis scenes, so... And it's something we're so used to seeing these days. It's on all the time. How do you go about filming something, making it look fresh and new that we're so used to seeing, like tennis?
Well, one of the things we did was just study the actual match and their style of play, you know, just really looking at tennis then. And we sort of fell in love with, you know, it's a very different kind of tennis. You know, the rackets were smaller and they played, you know, it wasn't power tennis.
Yeah.
And so we really wanted to capture that, and the event was, we cut it down to 10 minutes. We took the real match and, with our editor and cut it down and put music on it and started to get a feel for how the match would play in the film, and then just decided that we wanted to kind of duplicate that as much as possible.
Yeah, I mean, there have been a few tennis movies, and we made a creative decision early on that we were going to film the final match as it was seen on television. So it's a wider shot where you get to see the full bodies and you get to see the interplay of the two players, so that it's a little bit like filming dance. You know, you don't want to cut it up too much. You want just to see
the real play and, you know, not manufactured, not too cinematic. We didn't want it to, we wanted it to kind of feel like you're watching the actual broadcast for the audience.
Do you think then your background in music videos really shaped the way you filmed the tennis here?
Well, I think it affected our background in music video informed the way we use music.
Okay.
You know, we have a very big sort of forward score for the film, and it was fun to be able to show a tennis match but add a whole orchestra and, you know, just kind of build this drama that you never, you know, tennis is so well mannered, and for us to be able to have, you know, big musical hits on different plays, it was fun.
Well, and it was fun to kind of, you know, we created these themes throughout the movie, and then all those themes kind of came back and played at different points during the match. So, and that was really the idea, was to sort of develop the drama for the first part of the movie leading into the match, so that the match had all that drama buried in it.
Okay. Excuse me. So there are some previous versions of this story told. There's When Billy Beat Bobby with Holly Hunt and Ron Silver, and then there's the 2014 documentary. Was your rule, did you watch these? Was the rule avoid these, or were you just sort of unaware of these?
Well, we were very aware of all of them, and we did look at them.
Particularly the documentaries.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think it was important for us to cover new territory. And so the Holly Hunter film,
we didn't really watch that one. It was too, it was so different than the way we were telling the film. We just thought, I don't know if there's real value in
seeing that. But also, you know, that really focused on the match, and we wanted to go to places that hadn't been
Yeah, but it just wasn't that helpful to see something that was sort of a strange, very different version of what we were doing.
Okay. So can we talk about Bobby Riggs for a bit as well? So I think it could have been very easy just to have him as the villain, Billie Jean King as the hero, and obviously we do root for her, but then there is definitely some sympathy for Bobby. Can you talk about how you and Simon and Steve Carell as well sort of worked together to create this character?
Well, you know, I was thinking about it. I think that part of that came from Billie Jean's attitude toward Bobby, you know, that she didn't see him that way. She loved him, and they grew closer over the years after the match. But so I think she would have felt very strange if this movie painted him that way. And then, you know, when we watched all this footage and watched him on 60 Minutes and Steve saw him on these 60 Minutes interviews, there was so much more to his character and a kind of vulnerability that we all really, you know, we loved him, you know.
And I think that, you know, when you're telling a real life story, to reduce people to good guys and bad guys is a dangerous precedent. And so, you know, everyone has, you know, Bobby's not unlike many people in our lives. You know, he's an interesting, complex guy. So we wanted to honor that.
Okay. And the 70s setting, so obviously you have the costumes and the production design, but did you film on film? Because it really looks like you did.
No, it's 35 millimeter film. And no, that was a really important part to capture the feeling of the 70s. Mm. And we even asked the studio to allow us to change the logos at the start of the movie so that it's period logo. So our original intention was to make it feel like you're watching a movie about 1973 and you are in 1973.
Instead of looking back on it, we wanted it to feel contemporary, like it's happening now. And
we used a lot of zoom lenses
and old lenses, and you know, that's kind of our favorite era, favorite decade of movies. So we watched a lot of our favorite movies from the 70s with our DP and talked about.
Okay. What are your favorite movies from the 70s?
There's many. Okay. But I mean, for this, we watched a lot of Altman and Nashville in particular, and some John Cassavetes.
Killing of a Chinese Bookie. Mm-hmm. But you know, we're constantly looking at Hal Ashby movies. Yeah. So that was a big inspiration.
Do you always watch other films when you're making a new one, just to kind of get an idea of what else? You know,
we usually zero in on a couple and then just sort of study them because, I don't know, I guess it's just more meaningful to really get to know a work that you like.
And it sort of gets your blood flowing, you know, as a filmmaker. It's you're looking just for inspiration, not to replicate, but just to feel the power of filmmaking. And so it always is a great way to just...
But we always seem to turn to that decade. I don't know, for some reason. It's
probably because
so
that's
many.
Where we discovered movies, you know, as kids.
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously the big theme of the film, for me anyway, was gender inequality. Mm. And could you talk about the parallels there between that and within the film industry?
Well, I think it's unfortunately in so many industries. Yes. But while this was going on, there were a lot of discussions about pay equality in the film industry. And not just pay equality, but, you know, the number of female directors versus male directors is, you know, really out of balance. And so I just,
Well, we had a lot, our crew was composed of a real... you know, a good mix of men and women. I mean, I just, you know, we sought out the best people for the jobs, but all things being equal, you know, we, you know, wanted to make sure that women were properly represented. So our editor, our production designer, the sound designers, sound recordist, wardrobe, like there were lots of people. One of the directors is a woman.
Finally, then, you're reunited with Steve Carell here. Yes. What was it like working with him again after more than a decade?
He's a nightmare. No.
No, you know, we've talked to him over the years about finding another project, and this was such a perfect chance to, you know, use all his gifts, you know, as a comedian, as a dramatic actor. So we had a great time.
Yeah, it was fun because he got so much time to prepare. I mean, 4 months of working with, he worked with Bobby's coach and really, you know, got into the character. So it was, that was kind of a luxury. And he is a tennis player. Like, he has a tennis court at his house. So that was very convenient.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Great. Valerie Faris and Jonathan Dayton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
How were they, Sam?
Really, really quite lovely. They are, so they're a married couple, and it feels like you're going, when I went into the room, it felt like I was going into their living room or something, but I just sat down for a chat with them. I don't think I've done an interview where it's been me and then two people before, let alone two people that are married.
Yes.
So that was a first, and it did feel very homely, the whole interview, and hopefully that came across there, that they were very lovely people.
Yeah, well, when you look at Little Miss Sunshine and Ruby Sparks as well, there is, and this film, it's like with Instagram or Visco or something, where people set the temperature to a bit warmer, and you get that feeling as soon as you get into these films.
Yeah.
So let's get into Battle of the Sexes. I was in battle this morning.
Were you fighting the sexes?
No, it's on the southeastern line, just on the way to Hastings.
Well, Jake is wrong there, because the film is actually about an actual battle. This is a film that has been sort of in the sort of movie news world for probably around a decade now, I think.
Yeah, there's been a documentary already done
about it.
There's
a documentary about it. There was a TV film made in the early 2000s, I believe. You can hear me talk about that with the directors in the interview. And yeah, so it was going to be Danny Boyle. At one point, he stayed on as a producer, and then it was going to be, Brie Larson was going to play Billie Jean King, which would have been pretty good casting. But I think what we've got here is something quite light and comedic. It's shot on film, and it has that real sort of softness to everything you see. There's no sharp edges in this film. It feels very soft and very kind of grainy in a nice, comforting way.
Little Miss Sunshine obviously delves into a lot darker territory, but because it is given that kind of camaraderie, family feel, when you remember it, you don't quite remember stuff like Paul Dano's character's vow of silence and the suicide that affects or suicide attempt that begins
that starts
the film.
Yeah.
And Ruby Sparks goes into quite a dark psychological idea in this kind of creation of a manic pixie dream girl identity. And this, as you say, has soft corners, but that doesn't mean it's a bad thing at all.
Not at all. That's not a criticism at all. And I think that the match, the Battle of the Sexes itself, is overblown and ridiculous. And there is this thing throughout the film of how seriously is anyone taking this, because you see it in the film, there's like costumes, there are cheerleaders, which these are things that aren't associated with tennis. And she gives him a pig, like sort of to start the match off, because he's a chauvinist pig, and he kind of has this weird costume where he has this giant lollipop and these gold dancers around him. And I think the film matches the tone of about how serious you should take all of this, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So how does this all start? Historically speaking, we've got one person who is on the up, who is trying to kind of fight for the rights of women's tennis being treated in the same way as men's tennis. I mean, this is still an issue now. When you think of the Wimbledon prize money was only adjusted 2 years ago?
A few years ago. And even, you know, recent comments, like John McEnroe has made comments about how the quality of male tennis versus female tennis, and even you know, Djokovic has made some comments about these things before. And you also got like Andy Murray has always, you know, in press conferences, is always kind of sticking up for female tennis players. So it's crazy that, you know, 30, 40 years later, we're still talking about this.
Yeah.
And the film starts with Billie Jean King and a group of other female tennis players fighting for equal pay. And they form the WTA, which is a huge organization that's still used today.
And then you've got Bobby Riggs, who is an ex-pro, ex-number one, who at the beginning of the film, he's a gambling addict and he's kind of taking bets on whether he can still win a game of tennis if he's got three dogs playing with him or something like that.
He's also got this really great line where he's at a like, Gamblers Anonymous meeting and he says like, oh, we're not here because we're addicted to gambling. We're here because we're bad at gambling. Yeah. And he's quite a kind of a sad sack at the start, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, they do this thing with Bobby, which I think is a bit different to, and this is where it's different to Ruby Sparks or Little Miss Sunshine, in that perhaps in those films, he would have been made slightly more of a bad guy.
Yeah, and I think that could have been very easy to do. It could have been easy to do, oh, Bobby Riggs is the bad sexist pig, and then Billie Jean King is the hero that stands up to defeat him. But yeah, he's introducing him in that way allows you to see him as a person and not just the image that he is trying to present to the world, which is kind of interesting the way he like really tries to be unlikable in the public eye. I think just because he wants to be this clown.
Well, he's got in that way a touch of the Jose Mourinho, in that he knows what the press want to hear, and that he understands there's a difference between how you play the game and what you tell the press.
Yeah,
and maybe like I think this is an early appearance of what you do off the pitch, off the court, has as much impact on the court as the game itself.
I think so. And he has this saying, oh, I want to put the show back in chauvinism.
He's good with words.
He's very good with words. I think that's another thing as well, is that even when you watch clips of Bobby Riggs, he is really funny. Even though some of the things he's saying are quite horrible about women, you do get a sense that he doesn't really think this.
But you get swept up in it as well. And like even us as audience members, there are a lot of things that you laugh at, and you feel okay about laughing at it because, oh, it's from a different time period.
Yeah.
But then you laugh at it and you think, actually, that's probably still being said today. Yeah. And now, like, that's where it's got that pertinence from. And I think that's why it shows it, as well as stuff like the prize money discussion we already said, how much value it has now.
Absolutely. So there have been a few Battle of the Sexes. So the film shows the first one, which Billie Jean King declined. And that was when it was Bobby Riggs versus Margaret Court. And he beats Margaret Court. And there's this whole thing. Yeah, I've proved it. Male tennis players and female tennis players are not equal. And I thought the way they present Margaret Court was quite interesting as well. But so then it moves on to the big one that we know that the film's about. But there's also another one in 92, which was Martina Navratilova and Jimmy Connors, which Jimmy Connors won.
And Jimmy Connors is in...
Jimmy Connors is in Borg McEnroe briefly as well.
Yeah, because this is... I'd like to draw on your tennis knowledge, as I did in the previous tennis film of this year. So in the other tennis film, Borg McEnroe, we talked about how the fact that I didn't know the result of the game.
Okay.
And that actually played into my enjoyment of it. But you were under the belief that everyone knows the result of that game, which obviously I didn't. But in this case, do we assume that everyone knows the result of this game? I mean, it's safe to assume that this film wouldn't exist.
I mean, if you've never seen a film before, you might not know who wins, but come on. We'll tread around that then.
Yeah. So also around Emma Stone's Billie Jean King and Steve Carell's Bobby Riggs. We've got a whole host of other people. So Sarah Silverman as Gladys Heldman is really good fun. She's like a PR lady who sets up their organization at the beginning, turns it into a tournament, and from there develops this giant competition that ultimately looks like it's selling out an arena.
Yeah, and the film sometimes reminds me of Dodgeball.
Oh, yeah.
Because you have this, the underdog versus the sort of antagonistic professionals. Mm. And this kind of group of female tennis players that Sarah Silverman assembles do remind me a bit of the Average Joes.
Oh, yeah. This is your kind of ragtag team who are going to take down Globo Gym. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think there are things that have been really tightened by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris. Mm-hmm. I tightened and heightened, I would say, actually, because the writing credit is still Simon Beaufoy, who wrote the script for Danny Boyle and has written for him before on 127 Hours and Slumdog Millionaire. His script is a lot bigger and it's sprawling and you have a lot more characters and you have a lot more time spent with those characters.
You probably tacked.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
It tackled the era of the 70s culture as well.
That's it. And I think it's more looking at it as a sports film.
This film brings it back to who is battling in the Battle of the Sexes. And that's what the film is entirely about.
Yeah.
As much as we've spoken about this kind of dodgeball team thing going on, it is very much about these two people. And in the same way that we had with Borg McEnroe, it's not necessarily a sports film because the sport isn't actually on screen that much, really.
Mm.
It's more about this sort of gladiatorial mindset these people have to get into.
Yeah. And so these side characters, I think some of them obviously are real people.
Yeah.
And then you have the idea of a composite character as well.
Yeah.
And I think maybe Beaufoy's script had everyone as an individual character. I can see why when they're boiling it down to this is one person versus one person, let's not get too distracted by everyone else. And it benefits from that. But you mentioned as well that we don't see tennis on film that often, and we've suddenly seen two big movies in a short amount of time. And what that comes down to is that tennis is hard to play, and it's hard to recreate.
It is, and it's also it's on TV the whole year round. Every day you can find tennis somewhere to watch. It's not like it's this rare thing we don't get to see much anymore. We don't need to see every pot point of the game. And I think the way they shoot the final battle here is actually really nicely done.
Yeah, and I think, the path I was leading down there was that up until now, the only way that you could do a tennis film is with body doubles and then you cut to a close-up. So this was done in The Damned United for, there's Derby County, and then you cut to a close-up and it's, the Shane Meadows actor...
Paddy Considine.
No, the one from the Arctic Monkeys video. Oh, and he's in Lock, Stock and Stuff. What is his name? Stephen Graham.
So
in The Damned United, it's wide shots of footballers, close-up of Stephen Graham.
Right, okay.
But here, we're now at a point with CGI that you can actually have a wider shot or a mid shot.
Yeah.
And the movement... and the play has been done by a double, but we've got CGI face. Yeah. Emma Stone has been put on it. But ultimately, we're getting a better immersion from that because tennis moves so quickly. Yeah. You can imagine that is a nightmare to do.
Yeah.
But now that we're able to do that, we're actually really benefiting from it. And it's such a cinematic sport in a way.
Yeah. And as you heard in the interview there, Steve Carell has his own tennis court in his back garden. So we assume he's pretty good himself.
Mm.
So maybe didn't need much CGI there. There was a version of a film about the Battle of the Sexes that I remember reading about 5 years ago or something. I don't know if it was the Danny Boyle version, but it was going to star Tina Fey as Billie Jean King and then Will Ferrell as Bobby Riggs. And you can totally see that, but I think that would have been an out-and-out comedy.
Yeah, and I don't know whether that would really do the story the justice it needs.
Exactly.
It's the kind of thing that would have been inspired by.
But one of the bigger parts of the film is... looking at Billie Jean King's personal life, which they do treat very seriously. And this is actually what I didn't know much about going in, because I knew about the Battle of the Sexes. I'd seen the documentary. I knew the result of the game. I knew what Bobby Riggs was like. I knew what Billie Jean King meant for the sport and for sort of feminism. But I didn't know much about her personal life. And that's what the film does really, really well, I thought, was exploring that part of her life.
Yeah, because she's definitely at a crossroads. So she's with Larry King, not Larry King, but Larry King, her husband.
A man called Larry King.
A man called Larry King, who's actually probably the most sympathetic character
in
the film.
Yeah.
She meets Andrea Riseborough's character, who is Marilyn. Marilyn Barnett, who is a hairdresser, which is lovely stuff.
Lovely.
And so begins a romance there. And so not only is she in the midst of this enormous battle for her sports, for her livelihood, she's got this huge psychological dilemma as well about her own identity.
And it's not like they tread around or insinuate the relationship. They have it. There is a sex scene, which again, I thought did credit to this story, because you kind of need to know that going in. It's really important about her mindset during this game. Mm. And you also see stuff about Bobby's life. He's married to Elizabeth Shue, who were not actual Elizabeth Shue, but
what?
Yeah,
she's so playing herself.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Shue plays his wife, and you do see his personal life and with his son and his gambling addiction. Again, all contextual stuff that we need to know to really appreciate that this battle was as important for the sport and for our culture as much as it was for these two individuals in the ring.
Court. And that's what you need to ultimately care about it, because a million people in an arena and watching on tellies has its value, but you don't have any connection with those people. Yeah. And we need that to feel something when one character loses as well, that you don't think that, haha, I'm so glad they lost.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so there was a particular scene, or my favourite scene in the film, is the first time that Marilyn and Billie Jean meet, when her and the tennis team are getting their hair done. And Marilyn starts giving her a haircut and kind of, I can only say that she kind of floofs it and just like, she gets right in there.
There's a lot of floofing.
Yeah, but it becomes this very sensory experience.
Yeah, and it's a lot of close-ups, a lot of interesting stuff with sound.
Mm,
yeah.
And it's very tactile, and you really, without it being like a spotlight and Dreamweaver playing over it, you're getting that same feeling as
Does
well.
Does that happen in Dodgeball?
No, it's in Wayne's World, isn't it?
What's the song that plays when the skinny guy sees Franz Stelanovskovic for the first time?
That might be Dreamweaver. But it's in Wayne's World too.
What, when he first sees
Cassandra?
Right, okay.
Yeah. So this is not a spotlight moment, but it does it through really clever sound design. Yeah. And it's getting into that idea of film being a completely sensory experience.
Yeah.
And you're looking at that feeling of hairspray and the smell of that.
Yeah.
And the feeling that when you kind of walk through a cloud of it, that almost rain-like feeling that it has on your hands and face. And you get that feeling of the world dropping away in that moment without it being overly dramatic.
And that's a really nice moment that reminds you that the directors started in music videos.
Yes.
And they did loads of huge music videos, like the massive list you can look up online. Really impressive work. And that's a moment that really reminds you, they worked with just music and image, and that's all they had to back in those days, and that's a lot of what they're doing is now. It's just thinking about how the sound and the image collaborate together.
Yeah.
And the same with a couple of Mike Mills moments in 20th Century Women. Mm. You can really tell that this is how they started out, and this is what they're lending to feature film.
Yeah. So let's go back to Andrea Riseborough, who you sat down with as well earlier this year.
I did. When I went into the room, she had a huge plate of food down next to her, and she said, "Oh, everyone's going to think I'm some kind of warlord."
But she's not a warlord.
She's not a warlord. She is, in fact, a very nice actress. So.
Lovely. All right. Enjoy.
Andrea Riseborough, thank you for joining us. So we're here to talk about the Battle of the Sexes. Could you just tell us a bit about who you play in the film?
I play Marilyn, who it was Billie Jean King's, actually was a hairdresser at the time, and then they had this really beautiful affair, which was kind of an awakening for Billie Jean, and for Marilyn was, I think, a wonderful time in her life, so much so that she never really let it go. She was very much in love with Billy.
Right. And was Marilyn someone you knew about before you became involved?
No. I mean, I knew who Billie Jean King was, but I barely knew what Billie Jean King had done in terms of the fight for equal pay and female emancipation. And, you know, she's an incredibly powerful force in the world. And has been just so influential in the 20th century. I was really, really taken aback that we hadn't learned more about her in school.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I feel like British education was pretty wonderful in that way. We did a lot of suffrage and...
Yeah, well, I think I definitely wasn't taught anything about Billie Jean King, but we did a lot of emancipation stuff.
Yeah.
Outside of that, yeah. So you've played real people numerous times before. Is there an added pressure for you when you're playing someone who was real?
I think the pressure with this one was that she was dead.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then the pressure really is just honouring somebody posthumously and feeling like you have explored a time in their life. It was a beautiful time in their lives,
sure.
You know. And so that you've, yeah, honoured that time and told their story, shown their assets and their flaws.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a kind of a strangely different pressure.
Okay. So what kind of research went into this role? I mean, you met Billie Jean King, I assume, and spoke to her about Marilyn?
Not before, okay. No. And we were all very respectful of the
yeah.
fact that Billie is a real person.
Of course.
And that this was a really confusing time in her life. She
yeah.
was going through a lot of stuff. So, no, I didn't. There was a lot of still imagery. Well, very little still imagery, but there was some still imagery that I could get my hands on. There weren't any live interviews or anything because Marilyn
yeah.
wasn't a public figure. But I really got a sense of who she was in Billie's life.
Okay.
And I saw Val specifically when we were starting out. Val talked a lot about Marilyn being this catalyst in Billie Jean's life to see her body and her spirit as this sensual, liberated thing.
Yeah.
And not only as this incredibly powerful machine. So that was inspiring. That was kind of where we started off with her.
Right. Because I spoke to Valerie and Jonathan just now.
They're lovely, aren't they?
They are really nice.
Yeah, they're so sweet.
And they spoke about how when they came aboard, they sort of changed the script slightly, so it was more about the build-up to the event and more about the personal lives. I mean, so I assume they worked with you quite
closely.
Well,
that's the interesting story.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be, I think, deeply uninteresting to badly reenact something that was so
yeah.
largely covered in the media anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it just would be a... It would be doing a disservice to all of the main players.
Mm. So you mentioned there about how, you know, sort of passionate and beautiful their relationship was. But it did have a kind of, you know, very publicly unhappy ending. Did that knowledge affect your performance at all?
People ask that question a lot.
Yeah.
No, because if you were playing yourself
yeah.
at 29, would you take it into account what happened when you were 34?
Not at all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's just math, really.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, yeah, I didn't know that then. Right, great, yeah. Mike Lee taught me that.
So the film's... It also is kind of sympathetic to a degree to Billie Jean's husband, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
And Marilyn... I think Marilyn could have just been seen as sort of this other woman breaking up a relationship. But how did you work to keep her still sympathetic, even though there is this kind of...
Well, that's really
tension?
Interesting that you say that as a guy, because I think guys are more
right.
sympathetic.
Okay.
Toward him, and most women that I talk to think he's a rotter. You
oh,
know,
really?
I mean,
okay.
not that everything has to be villainized
yeah,
in that
course.
Way, but people have to be villainized in that way. But I think it's very much a perspective thing. I don't.
Yeah.
I think that's more a gender
okay.
thing, personally, in terms
yeah.
of the questions I've been asked.
Okay.
Guys ask that, and then
yeah.
women ask the opposite.
Oh, right, okay, interesting. So you mentioned there that how lovely Valerie and Jonathan were. I mean, not only is it interesting being directed by two people, but by a married couple. What was that like?
Just they're very complicit. It's like, it's just very natural.
Yeah.
There's no awkwardness. It's not clunky. They're incredibly respectful of just everybody's talent. They really want to employ you, and then they want you to do your job and your best, you know,
yeah.
and they bring that out in everyone across the board, you know, makeup, sound design, everyone. And they have a sense of, you know, there's a great sense of ease in the way that they direct, and they have so much integrity, you know, they're not egotistical, they're not obsessed with any sort of like power struggle on set. They just want to make good work.
Yeah.
I think that's very apparent when you meet them, you know,
yeah,
that they're really just all about the work.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So obviously the big theme in the film is pay inequality and gender inequality. Can you talk about the parallels in the film to sort of how the film industry is at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly gotten worse, the film industry. But there are some things that are happening now which are making it better. I think people are speaking out. People are being held accountable. You know, I speak out regularly, and as I think most female actors do, we're still yeah. female actors. There's a whole debate about what we should call ourselves, you know. But and I don't care if it annoys people. I don't care.
Mm.
I'll say it as many times as I like. I'm not paid as much as men.
Okay, great. And so by the time this interview comes out, then we'll have already seen you in The Death of Stalin.
Yeah.
Can you quickly talk about what it was like working with Armando and that incredible cast?
Oh, God. Armando is one of my favourite people in the world, firstly. But he's so brilliant. He doesn't, you know, he's constantly working on it. And his team are incredible. They're all constantly working on... It's a real collaboration, you know. Mm. So I improvised a lot, and it's like my sweet spot to be sort of like improvising politically. That's like right. I couldn't think yeah. of anything other than like comedy and politics. But it was just such a great experience. It was me and Olga is in it, yeah. who I made a different film with, and then you know like 15 men, all of whom are. Just such lovely people. We laughed so much. And it's strangely timely in the way that Battle of the Sexes is timely, yes. in the sense that you're watching, you know, 14 white heterosexual males incompetently fuck up a country.
Yeah.
I can't think of any parallels there.
And then can you talk about what you've got coming up next?
We've got a film. My company has been part of making a film, and that's going to come out soon.
Okay.
It's called Nancy, and then I start shooting very soon in Toronto. I don't know whether it's been released yet. You know what I mean? I don't know whether
I've
said it yet in public, yeah. but I'm okay. shooting in Toronto.
Awesome. Excellent. Andrea Riseborough, thank you for your
Thanks
time.
Thanks so
Cheers.
Much. Thank you.
Thank
Thanks
you.
For coming.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
So there we are. Andrea Riseborough, Warlord.
Warlord Andrea Riseborough, yes.
Excellent. We will probably have to wrap up on Battle of the Sexes there.
Yeah.
One final thought that I would just like to bring up is that because this is in the 70s, it means there's lots of Zooms, which I love. I love seeing a Zoom because I remember in my first film class of A-level, I remember them just saying, no one Zooms anymore, don't Zoom. And you watch stuff like The Graduate, which is just completely full of Zoom. And because this is shot on 35mm, and because they're making it to feel like it's been made in the 70s, you get lots of lovely, stupid, silly Zooms, but they feel really natural without being like super comical. But I really like seeing those.
Yeah.
But it is not the only film out this week, Battle of the Sexes is not. We also have another film called Beach Rats, which you're going to tell us about, Sam.
Yes. So Beach Rats is, I guess the best way to describe it would be a coming-of-age drama. So we start with Frankie, played by Harris Dickinson, and he's alone in his room. He's not really clear of his age, but I'd guess around sort of 17, 18. And he's on a male video chat website. And very clearly you think, okay, this is a gay man we're watching. And he talks to some guys on there. And then in the next scene, he's hanging out with his friends who are all kind of wearing these kind of bro vests and flat caps, smoking weed, hanging out. And I think instantly you realize he's someone that leads a double life. None of his friends know about his sexuality, and they go out and they pick up girls, and they the best way to describe it would be they kind of lad about.
Mm.
They hang out on the beach, as the title suggests. They hang out on this kind of boardwalk in Brooklyn. The film really looks about how Frankie comes to terms with juggling both sides of his life. And I think a lot of people will compare this to other films that explore homosexuality in young men. I mean, recently we've had Call Me By Your Name, and last year we had Moonlight, and we had
God's Own Country.
God's Own Country. And some of those comparisons are merited. I mean, I definitely think in terms of Moonlight, there is this almost dreamlike aspects to certain parts of it, and it's not, but I think importantly, this isn't a tragic story, I think it's, but it also doesn't full on celebrate it either. It's just, it's more about how the struggle of him coming to terms with his sexuality and these two sides of his life.
Well, as I understand it as well, similarly to Call Me By Your Name, is kind of loose on the definitions of his sexuality
Well. I think the word, they don't use the word gay very much. I think what these films are doing is looking at, you're not defined by your sexuality.
Yeah.
And that's what he does really well. He meets up with men that he meets online for kind of anonymous sex. And films often would portray that as this kind of seedy, sinister underworld. And this film doesn't really, which was quite refreshing. It didn't show this as a sort of a dangerous place.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to be seeing these days. I think the internet for too long has been seen as a completely dangerous space without actually looking at the opportunities that being, as much as you have a wall to hide behind, for a lot of people, having that wall enables communication.
Absolutely, yeah. And it allows him, you can tell that he is happy when he meets these men. Mm. He has the key, his tastes are older men. Mm. And again, a lot of films would show, or a young man meeting older men online for sex could be a dangerous issue, but it's not. He is happy. This is what he wants to do. The only only sort of negative parts come from how no one around him knows about this side of his life. Mm. So Harris Dickinson really carries the film. Really talented young actor.
And I think he's nominated for some awards for it as well, or just announced.
He is. So this week they announced the Independent Spirit Award nominations.
This is kind of your American counterpart to the BIFAs that were announced a couple of weeks ago.
Exactly,
as well.
Yeah. And Harris Dickinson is nominated for Best Male Lead for Beach Rats. And quite a few films that we've spoken about in the past few weeks.
Oh, I mean, we do tend to pick pretty exceptional films.
That's because we elevate these films to a level.
Yeah, American Spirit Awards are thinking, which ones have they done on the Curzon podcast?
The Curzon Film podcast spoken about. And they're like, oh, okay, yeah, well, we'll pick that. We'll pick that. Let's see what Sam and Jacob had to say.
Yeah,
So Call Me By Your Name is nominated for many, many awards. Mm. Best film, best director, best acting. Also, Good Time is nominated for loads of awards.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Pattinson, good to see him getting a nomination for that.
Yeah, best director, I think, which is a really good shout. And supporting actor for Benny Safdie, which I think is
totally
really
deserved.
Really, yeah.
Yeah. And then we've also got Killing of a Sacred Deer is nominated for a few.
Yeah, but definitely cinematography. That's a lock-in.
Cinematography is nominated for that. And your mate, Barry Keoghan.
Yes, my pal. Yeah.
Your buddy.
Yeah.
So Matt Spicer's film, Ingrid Goes West. We spoke about it last week and had Matt Spicer on the show. He's nominated for Best Screenplay and Best First Film.
Yeah, it's amazing that that's a first feature.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. He liked my tweet.
Oh, mate.
So that was a big moment.
Oh, well done.
I'm very happy with that.
Good man. All right. If you have seen some of those films and you want a bit more discussion on them, go back and check out our old episodes on them if you haven't heard them already. But for next week, if you have any thoughts on Battle of the Sexes or Beach Rats and would like to share them with us, do email us. We have an email address now. It's podcast@curzon.com. And we'd love to start receiving your thoughts on these films that we talk about. And we'll be kind of doing them on a week-by-week basis on the one that we did the week before. So next week, we'll be looking for your emails on Battle of the Sexes. So do send them in.
Yes, and the podcast is out every week on iTunes and SoundCloud. And if you like it, please review us.
Mm. Yeah, do leave us a review. It helps us build an audience. Subscribe. Do leave us a comment as well.
Mm-hmm.
We would really, really appreciate it. Until next time, it's goodbye from Sam.
Thanks for listening.
And it's goodbye from me. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.